15 of the Woke-ish podcast. This is Ebony.
And this is Zelma.
And this week we will be discussing the topic, athletes in violence, perpetrators or victims.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun. But before we get there, we will start out with our shout-out segment. So our first shout-out goes to Walter Carr. Walter Carr apparently walked nearly 20 miles to get to his new job after his car broke down. When his boss found out what happened, she let him borrow her car and started a GoFundMe to buy Walter a new car. The fund got $11,000 as of Tuesday, when they had initially only set out to make $2,000. So, I mean, it's been extremely successful. And so you're probably asking yourself how that happened. Well, Walter was all set to start a new job with Bellhop's Moving, but his car broke down. And he really needed this job, so instead of calling off or borrowing a set of wheels, he started walking at midnight to get to the job nearly 20 miles away. So the I was reading the story, and it was saying that when he looked it up on, like, Google Maps, like, the walking distance, it said it was going to take him 7 hours.
Oh, my gosh. I was wondering why he started at midnight.
Yeah, and he had to get there, by 8 a.m. So Pelham police officers apparently saw him walking and offered him a ride and took him to breakfast before taking him to the moving job. But what I actually didn't write down here is that there was... First, he was walking, and he had walked about 2 hours, and then he sat down on the curb to rest, and some cops, like, drove past him and asked him, like, oh, is there, like, do you need any help? Is everything okay? And he told them their story, and they were so moved that they took him to breakfast, and then after breakfast, just, like, dropped him off, but he still had another 3 hours. Mm. So then he started walking again, and then another set of police officers saw him, and then he told them the story, and then they took him to the moving job. And then he ended up getting there early, and the person who he was helping move asked, like, you know, oh, you're here early. Do you want to rest and wait for the rest of the movers? And he was like, nah, like, I'm going to get started now. So he started and everything, and, yeah, I mean, then his boss heard about it, and they were, like, so impressed by him that, yeah, they let him borrow their car. And the Pelham Police Department tweeted, proud to have encountered this young man. He certainly made an impact on us. Exclamation point. Hashtag Pelham PD. Hashtag be like Walter. Yeah. So shout out to him. He now is on the way to having a new car and to, I mean, making it to work early and on time. So good for him and that work ethic.
Yeah, and they have a video showing him, like, I don't know if he's finding out that they bought him a car, but he's in tears, and it's just, yeah, I honestly, I would have just called in.
This is my story, and I'll send you a picture of my car broken down if you need.
I mean, like, sometimes I call in and say my car broke down, and it hasn't. So.
No, I feel that. It'll be like that sometimes. And then our second shout-out goes to the U.S. Navy, which, you know, some of these shout-outs are kind of half-hearted, because I'm like, do y'all really deserve a shout-out for this? But, so the United States Navy is finally joining the Marines, Army, and Air Force and ending its ban on dreadlocks for female sailors. The Naval Branch announced the reversal Tuesday in a live broadcast on its Facebook page. So Petty Officer First Class Jacqueline Leak, a member of the working group, has worn dreadlocks since 2014. She actually led efforts to reverse the ban and says her fight involved years of research on the cultural and health aspects of wearing locks. She also surveyed dozens of female sailors affected by the ban. Before the ban was lifted, Leak opted to cover her shoulder-length dreadlocks by wearing a wig, which she says became more difficult as her hair grew. Options were even more limited for other female sailors. Some were forced to choose between cutting off their dreadlocks in favor of chemically straightened hair or facing harsh punishment. So, I mean, with that story, you could probably kind of see how it's like, do y'all deserve a shout out? I mean, y'all are way behind the curve, and it's like, why is this something that was gendered in the first place? Like, why were dreadlocks banned just for women? That's kind of strange to me, and I feel like, you know, while they were banned just for women, I feel like it disproportionately impacts Black women, because, I mean, obviously people of all races do have dreadlocks, but I think that they're more most common among, you know, Black people. So it's like, you know, we are, like, Black women in this context were the ones being disproportionately affected by this ban. So we could say it was a race and gender, kind of discrimination. But anyways, regardless of what the reality is, shout out to the U.S. Navy for finally, you know, getting with the program.
And for Jacqueline Leak, because, you know, she, it's so much easier just to say, like, fine, I'll just cut off. I'll just cut it off and then, like, you know, just deal with it. But she, you know, actually fought with evidence and research to show, and it says years of research and interviews and surveys, and so shout out to her. Like, definitely, you know, if we want to highlight anyone in this story, it would be her.
True. Yeah. Okay, so now we will transition into our In the Know segment. Okay, so now for our In the Know segment. First on the docket is this sports Sports Illustrated story that I came across. So Sports Illustrated swimsuit model Mara Martin breastfed her baby on the runway. She made a bold statement on the runway as she walked while breastfeeding her 5-month-old daughter at the Paraiso XSI swimsuit show. Not really sure if that's how that's pronounced.
Probably like Paraiso, like paradise.
Yeah. But what is it? Paraiso?
Paraiso.
Paraiso. XSI swimsuit show. And so there was a lot, I mean, as you can probably imagine, there was a lot of pushback against this, because breastfeeding in public is, you know, becoming a trend, and a lot of, it makes apparently a lot of people uncomfortable. And so I was wondering for you, like, what do you think about this new quote unquote feminist trend, particularly as an expectant mother? Like, do you think that that's something that you would participate in? Like, do you think that it is a, do you think that it is a good feminist cause to rally behind?
So I saw this story with my mom, and my mom was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, like, my mom is not against breastfeeding, but she definitely was like, that's ridiculous. Like, I can't believe she's doing that. And I just thought it was really interesting that she said that. And then I have, the only other time I've actually seen someone breastfeed in public where it was like, gasp, was at a conference. I didn't see it, but I heard the story. I was at the conference and someone told me. And apparently this woman was presenting, and while she was presenting, she was breastfeeding.
Oh, shit.
And it's like, everyone, the thing is, like, she's you know, well known, she does a lot of good research, but, like, she, every time people talk about her, they refer to her as, like, the breastfeeding presenter.
Oh, no.
So it's, I don't know, I think, I don't know if she was intentionally like, you know what, I'm going to make a statement about this, because people were like, well, she couldn't have waited the 10 minutes till after her, you know, presentation to just go and breastfeed her kid. But then the other part is like, well, you know, why is that such a big deal? Because we're exposed to, like, boobs and breasts, like, all the time on TV, like, Instagram, the Kardashians and their topless photos, like, everyone's all down for the free the nipple, and everyone's down to see Kim K's nipples and all the Jenner's nipples and Rihanna's nipples, but no one is, like, okay to see, like, the use of a breast, which is, you know, one of the uses is to feed children. And so I am gonna breastfeed, and I think that wherever I am, if I will, I don't know, they have these, like, I don't know if you've seen them, but they're, like, kind, they look like aprons, but, you know, you tie them around your neck, and it's supposed to be, like, a cover. So I think if I was, like, at the airport or something, I would breastfeed, I would use the cover. But I don't know, because I also saw, like, on Instagram where it was a photo and it was a woman breastfeeding, and, like, one of the captions was, would you be okay if your girl did this in front of your guy friends? And I guess it was, like, a a guy posing the question.
And she had the apron on?
No.
Oh, she didn't. Her breast was exposed.
Her breast was exposed. Mm. And I was just kind of like, I wonder what, you know, that it's, you know, of course, reading the comments, people were like, no, that's disrespectful. And other people were like, well, you know, people are sexualizing her. She's feeding her child. Like, that's, it's not like, so I don't know. I think it's one of those, like, maybe in the moment I'll really know. But, like, right now, I think that if my baby was hungry and I was at, I don't know, I think I would be okay breastfeeding in public, but I also know that I would probably get, like, I'm just thinking, like, if someone asked me to leave, like, I would lose my shit. If someone was like, excuse me, can you please be more respectful and do that in the bathroom? I don't know how I would handle that either. So it's just kind of like, would I rather avoid going off on someone or just use this cover or just, like, say, fuck it and breastfeed in the open and, you know, potentially risk having to have a confrontation with someone. And I think that that's a sad kind of conversation that I have to have with myself. But I don't know. I'll definitely keep you updated because it's something recently that I've started thinking more and more about, especially, you know, since I'm a student. And in speaking with my advisor, one of the issues was, okay, like, where am I going to breastfeed because, or even pumping. It's just, I don't know. And even in the bathroom, like, you really,
yeah,
you,
the
like,
bathroom is, like, disgusting.
You have to, like, take your shirt off to pump. It's not like you can just, like, put it under your shirt. Maybe some people do. You can, like, depending on the pump that you get, you can, like, walk around, I guess. Actually, I don't know how they work.
And some bathrooms do have, like, little maternity sections with, like, a couch or sofa or whatever. But for the most part, like, that doesn't exist. And so I think that in terms of public institutions, if you aren't providing the space for breastfeeding mothers to breastfeed or pump, like a maternity ward or something like that, or a room, then you should not then be, I mean, it seems like criminalizing mothers for breastfeeding or pumping in public.
Yeah.
No, like, you know, it's like you can't have it both ways. Like, what am I, I'm going to go and sit in the bathroom where people are using the bathroom. It's uncomfortable. It stinks.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to feed my child in there because you haven't provided a space for me to do something that's natural.
Yeah. Or the fact that, you know, in this particular instance, it's like people would have been okay with seeing her boobs in a swimsuit, but they were not okay with her, you know, feeding a child with her boob. And it's just kind of like, so I don't know. I feel like it's a very, it's a huge double standard. And it's like, I don't like or appreciate having, like, so much, you know, I mean, what we see in the media isn't a lot of those times are natural breasts anyways. So it's like to be bombarded with these images that, like, a lot of men just, like, find very appealing. And, like, when you're a woman and you're just sitting there, like, watching a commercial and you're like, okay, it's a... I mean, even Victoria's Secret commercials where you're like, you know, they're geared towards women, but it's like, are they really? Because they're really sexualized in a way that I think it's supposed to be very appealing for men.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I'm supposed to, as a woman, put up with all this over-sexualization of breasts, seeing, like, unrealistic breasts, seeing Photoshop breasts, all these things. But then when, like, a natural event is occurring where a child is being fed, I'm supposed to be ashamed for that. And it's just, I don't know, it's just a huge double standard. So maybe, like, if there was a situation where I could make a statement like this, I would. But I'm, like, even imagining, like, teaching. Can you imagine if, like, a professor was breastfeeding while she was teaching? Like, that would be...
Well, I mean, I think that you're right. In this particular story, she's a Sports Illustrated model.
Yeah.
So the people that are complaining about this have probably maybe not seen her full naked breast, but have probably seen enough of her exposed body to like, know what her boobs look like.
Yeah.
So it's not like she's, you know, like you're saying, like some person that they've seen fully clothed or whatever. And, I mean, also... probably not in this particular context, but generalizing out to other scenarios, like, say maybe at the airport or something like that. The same people that would be looking at a mother, like, all sideways and stuff like that if her baby was crying because they were hungry are the same people that are looking at her sideways for breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And it's like, again, you can't have it both ways. Like, either my baby is going to be crying because they have hunger pains or I'm going to feed them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like you're saying, like, breastfeeding is something that's super natural. The use of a breast to breastfeed is what it's for.
Yeah.
And yet we have sexualized it. And so we're uncomfortable because we have sexualized something that wasn't sexual in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. People are crazy, man.
People are crazy. So we'll see. I mean, maybe you'll be there when I do one of these. I might feel better.
I might get a sign.
I understand. Yeah,
she's breastfeeding and what?
Yeah, I understand why, like, people do, like, the protests with people. Because it's, like, I would definitely feel safe. Not just, it's not about feeling like, oh, I would feel empowered to do this. It's, like, I would just feel safer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I'm breastfeeding and someone comes up to me and there's someone else being like, you're crazy. What she's doing is okay. Look away if it's not something that you... And if your child doesn't know that, you know, people breastfeed, then they're gonna... You should really teach your child because it's...
What I think is that a lot of times women, and I could be wrong about this, but I think that a lot of times women complain about situations like this when they claim that their husbands are uncomfortable, when in actuality they are uncomfortable with their husbands looking.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so it's like, I'm not wrong for feeding my kid. Your husband is a creep for being turned on or whatever by this process.
And like, it might not even be turned on, but it's just like the fact that we are taught to sexualize, like, even, like, we, meaning men and women, are taught to sexualize boobs. So if, like, a man, and I'm sure there are men who are creeps and just want to look because it's, like, an open breast, but if a man just was, like, you know, looked over just to be like, oh, wow, she's breastfeeding, like, automatically the woman would be like, oh, well, she's obviously being sexualized in that moment because...
Yeah, which is not her fault.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, I think it's... If you are so distracted by a woman breastfeeding because of the way that you view breasts, that's a personal issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I think that what I'm trying to figure out is, like, I think that there are, like, I don't know. I think that this situation, and I've been seeing the whole, like, you know, normalized breastfeeding movement kind of blowing up on social media and, like, on Instagram with mothers, like, posting pictures of themselves breastfeeding and stuff. And it makes me wonder if there's just, like, a... not right or wrong, but, like, better or more productive or more efficient way of protesting. Because I don't know. I don't really think that a picture of you breastfeeding your baby in your home is, like, I don't think it resonates with folks in the same way as if, like, you, and then I also don't know, I mean, because does it come down to breastfeeding in public or not? Or does it come down to breastfeeding covered in public or not?
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking about, like, you know, when my siblings were born and my mom always had, like, a, you know, like, covered her shoulder in the baby's head with, like, a jacket or something like that. You know, and, so, and like, I never thought, you know, once or twice about that. But I haven't seen... someone breastfeeding in public uncovered, and I wonder if that would be weird to me. Like, if I, not weird, but, like, if that would, you know, throw me off a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And is that what mothers are fighting for the right to do, is to just, you know, like, breastfeed uncovered in public?
Yeah, no, that would definitely be, I think, worth having a further discussion on, like, along the road and in a separate episode too. And because I think that's true. Like, I don't know if it's just the fact that it's an act that people don't think should be done in public at all, or if it really is people are like, you know, just, you know, the fact that you aren't being doing discreet, it the right way. Like, the fact that you're not doing it the right way is what's problematic. Because, I mean, she, in this instance, she didn't cover herself.
Yeah.
And in the instance of the conference, she didn't cover herself. And so it's just like, is it controversial because it was done in a situation where they were the only one doing it, and it was super highlighted that they're choosing to breastfeed in that moment when So that means something, or is it that they didn't cover themselves and that's what makes it controversial? So that would be interesting to see, and maybe,
yeah,
you know, investigate more and look into what it is that this movement is doing. And that's something for sure I will do personally as I'm, you know, navigating what it is to prepare to be a mother. But breastfeeding is definitely something that is very important to me, and you know, you just can't, there's no way to schedule your life around feeding your child, because they have to eat every couple of hours.
Yeah.
And I can't like always go to a room every couple, yeah, of hours just to do that. So I'm going to have to figure out like what it is that I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we are here for you. You've got my support. You can use my office.
Okay.
Okay. So, we're going to talk about our second In the Know story.
Yeah, so recently they had the ESPY Awards. So the ESPYs, and it's just an award show for athletes, professional athletes. And so in the ESPYs, they have the Author Ash Courage Award. And it's an award given to athletes who show display courage. And in this in the 2018 ESPYs, what was so, I think, moving is, I don't know if any of you guys have been following, but there's, you know, the sexual abuse scandal with Larry Nassar, who was the physician on a lot on the USA gymnastics team, and he'd also held other positions as well. I know he was also in Michigan, the university, I think, I have to look, it's either University of Michigan or Michigan State. I know it's a huge difference. And so what I found really, really just impactful was the fact that they, over 100 women just went on stage to represent all the women that he had victimized. And so Jennifer Gardner presented the Courage Award to the hundreds of child athletes who have spoken out about the horrific sexual abuse that they experienced while under the care of the now imprisoned, oh, it's Michigan State and USA gymnastics doctor. Yeah. And like, what's worse than just this being 100, over 100 women, and that this abuse occurred over 30 years, but that these were like children. Like, they started when they were preteens, and for a lot of them, the abuse continued for a long time. And so Allie Reisman, who is one of the gymnasts on the USA gymnastics team for the most recent Olympics, and she was also on the team for the Olympics before that, mm-hmm, said that perhaps the greatest tragedy of this nightmare is that it could have been avoided. And she says that because she says, apparently, I think that she recounted that there were 7 times in 7 different years where they had filed complaints against him and told the USA Gymnastics organization that they were being abused by this physician. And she said that they always told her, you're misinterpreting what he's doing. Do you really know what you're doing? And kind of raising these complaints. And so she says, whether you act or do nothing, you are shaping the world that we live in, impacting others. All we needed was one adult to have the integrity to stand between us and Larry Nassar. And he now is spending, I think he got over 100 years. He's spending the rest of his life in prison. And what I found also really great about this is they highlighted 3 women. One was apparently the first victim of his, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then Allie Reisman, who was the most, I think, well-known because she was the captain of the USA gymnastics team, and she was very vocal. She wrote a book, and when she, mm-hmm, talked about all of this, and she took a lot of heat because a lot of people kind of accusing her of like misinterpreting and being like, well, he's a physician, he was obviously like, you know, doing physical therapy on you. And she was very adamant that no, that this was wrong. And after she came out and said all these things, a lot of other teammates of hers came out, because apparently none of them knew that was happening to each other. And so after she came out, like, a lot of her other team members came out and said, oh yeah, he did this to me too. And so what I found really interesting and was that one of the 3 girls that they highlighted was a woman of color, and she was a softball player. Mm-hmm. And so she talked about how sexual abuse claims victims in every race, showing no discrimination. And she just talked about how, you know, it was an honor for her to represent the victims of color that were impacted and affected by Larry Nassar, because it's not just white women who are impacted by this, mm-hmm. this story. Although it had been highlighted mostly the experiences of white women, mm-hmm. I really liked that they gave her an opportunity to speak for the women of color. And even though there were 141 people talking about on stage receiving the award, mm-hmm. they said that this isn't all of them, that this is only the people who chose. So I know, like, my eyes, like, teared up watching, because they were singing a song, and then you watch all these women go on stage, and you're like, holy shit, oh my God, like, just rows and rows and rows of women. And I didn't even know,
like, I'd been hearing about this story for, like, you know, like, a year. You know, yeah. And I didn't know that the women had been putting forward complaints against, or filing complaints against him.
Yeah, yeah.
This whole time, and just no one did anything.
Yeah, Ali said that they kept putting medals and awards for the well-being of people. So it was just kind of like, if you say anything now, we're going to lose credibility. We don't want to, you know, take away from the gymnastics team opportunity to earn gold. And then just thinking, like, the most, probably one of the most special times of her life, earning a gold medal, earning a silver medal at the Olympics, is the whole time she was, like, being abused by the doctor. Yeah. And so thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, it's, and then you just even, like, I even now in my head I'm replaying, like, just, like, her smiling and crying because she was so happy and talking about the team, and then just being, like, that whole time she was just being abused, and not just abused, but abused for years, and just how frustrating that must be, and to have to compartmentalize that and to be, like, okay, well, this is for the team, and then thinking, like, these are very young girls, and they, you know, you start gymnastics when you're young, and you're so vulnerable because you're trusting that this doctor's going to help you, and the whole time he's, like, feeling you up, and it's just, so I was really, really happy that the ESPYs presented this award to all the survivors, and it gave them, like, 10 minutes for them to talk about, like, give speeches, and allowed all, like, 141 of them to be on stage, and then everyone in the audience gave them standing ovations and stood up for the whole 10 minutes of their speech, and it was just, you know, for as much as I sometimes complain about the Me Too movement kind of really focusing on the experiences of privileged people, I was just kind of like, you know, maybe out of all of them, maybe a handful are super famous athletes. A lot of them were just athletes at Michigan State. A lot of them were just athletes. And so it was just kind of like thinking, like, 100 women are standing there, but that's 100 families. Mm-hmm. That's 100 relationships. Like, they're all mothers now. And just thinking, like, this one man just, like, impacted the lives of so many people. Yeah, and they're right. Like, one person could, one adult who had listened to them could have helped. And then at the end, they kind of gave a shout out to the assistant attorney, to the judge, and to an investigator, who all happened to be women, who were the ones that finally were like, no, we believe you, and prosecuted the case. And they were there, the judge was there, and it was just really nice. And it was just kind of, I had been following the story because I really love the gymnastics team. And it was just really nice to see that they were able to get, like, some sort of closure where they were recognized for the fact that as athletes, I think it is very courageous to have to say that someone, to put yourself out there and say, I'm a victim of sexual abuse, because as we know, sometimes women are always questioned, like, whether they were even abused at all. Yeah. And so definitely it was very touching, sad moment, but I really hope that this will shine light to this issue, and that hopefully we can be, you know, this is exactly what I want the Me Too movement to be, which is, like, show women that if for a moment maybe you can lose your voice, you can lose yourself in this abuse, but you can always regain it. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so shout out to them. They're very courageous.
Yes.
And I mean, I hope that it's a shame to think that, you know, these are things that happen in our, like, at our universities and stuff, and it's probably much more common than we would like to think, but let him serve as evidence that, you know, like, this is not, this era is not the era of, you know, women kind of, you know, continually being silenced.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like you said, women are finding their voices, and so as long as men continue to try to take advantage, y'all will be put under the jail.
Yes, yes,
hopefully.
Yes.
Fingers crossed.
Yes.
Okay, so now we are going to transition into our What's Being Slept On segment.
So I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
Okay, so now for our What's Being Slept On segment, we're going to be discussing athletes and abuse, perpetrators, and victims.
Yes.
So y'all probably have heard about this already, but I think it's an important discussion to be had. So, talking about the NFL and domestic violence, and, you know, kind of with a particular focus on the LeSean McCoy and Delicia Corden situation, and how, you know, that's kind of been all over social media, at least, for the last few weeks. And, you know, it's been hard to really pin down how, like, what my feelings are about it, just because, you know, the story just, there's so much craziness, so many different levels and components to the story that we, you know, Zelma and I were thinking that it would be kind of an important conversation to have. So, got just a few statistics here. So apparently domestic violence is the NFL's highest category for arrest. That's at 55.4%. Although it's lower than the national average, it's more than four times worse than the league's arrest rates for all offenses. And so then kind of centering down and focusing on LeSean McCoy and Delicia Corden, for those of you that haven't heard, McCoy was trying to evict Delicia after they broke it up, and, you know, she was living at his home. So he'd been, I'm a little bit, like, the stories are a little bit conflicting on this. So apparently he called the police a little over a year ago and had reported that he and his girlfriend at the time had broken up and that he'd been asking her to leave and she wouldn't. So I'm not sure if they got back together after that and now they're broken up again and he's trying to get her to leave, or if he's actually been trying to get her to leave for a year. Mm-hmm. Like, that seems kind of excessive. So he's been trying to evict her. He asked for some of the jewelry, or asked for the jewelry back that he bought her. And I guess one night while, I think it was 3 a.m., while he was gone, she was at the home, and there was a violent home invasion that occurred in which she was assaulted and I think she said pistol whipped. And so at first, Delicia pointed the blame to McCoy and said that, you know, she felt like he was behind this invasion, because she said that the person, the assailant, asked her for specific jewelry, which were jewelry pieces that McCoy had purchased for her. But now, he denied, of course, that, you know, he was behind it. And now, within the last few days, she has kind of said that she's, like, you know, unsure if mm-hmm. he was behind it. And she has since apparently moved out of the house. And then, you know, also, I don't know how long ago that was. Was that a year or two ago?
For which one?
With Ray, for Ray
yeah,
Lewis?
Yeah, Ray Lewis, it's been a while. Probably, like, I think 2016, maybe.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah.
So, like, 2 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, 2 years ago, if y'all recall, Ray Lewis was caught on hotel video knocking out his then-fiancé, now-wife, as the elevator doors opened.
After that, apparently the NFL created this task force, or this, the NFL's Players Association Commission on Violence Prevention. And so I think as a result of this, they were just kind of like, okay, this is a learning experience. We didn't know how to handle this. And, you know, we were kind of wrong because he did tell us about it and we told him it was okay. But, you know, we should have looked at the video. We didn't see the video at the time. It wasn't available. How would we have known that it was bad? We were going off his word. Plus, she's saying that everything's okay and they're married. So is it really bad to, you know, there are no criminal charges because she's not charging, you know, she's... Although, I think now, even if the state can go ahead with the charges. So, in some cases, even though the woman or the victim doesn't want to press charges, the DA's office can take the charges themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, after that, the whole incident with Ray Lewis, the NFL was like, ooh, we look really bad, so let's just make this commission. And after that is when they were like, okay... From now on, if you get in trouble with domestic violence, like, you're not going to play. Like, it's going to be for real. And I think things just really complicated that. The fact that his fiance stayed with him and married him. And so, you know, it's just harder to... It's harder... It makes it more complicated to punish someone when the person who was the victim doesn't want them to be punished. Mm-hmm. And then also the fact that technically he had disclosed to the NFL that he did hit her, but he didn't, I guess, unless he said, like, yeah, I knocked her out unconscious, then, but the video wasn't available. The video wasn't supposed to be available. Apparently someone leaked it at the hotel and you're not supposed to do that. And so there's just kind of a lot of complicated things. But I mean, Ray Lewis is still not looked at the same by a lot of people. Yeah. So I think that he kind of lost a lot of credibility with his fans, with many of his fans. And he lost a lot of sponsorship. And, you know, he's now the butt of many jokes. And but... The NFL, after that, was like, okay, maybe there is a domestic violence answer, and seemingly did something to fix it and tried. And after that, they were kind of being more female inclusive, trying to center it more. I think they were like, quote unquote, trying to win back their female fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that... With that, we should transition into our first question, because I think it's like, you know, it's a really big one. I think particularly after all of this, like over the last 2 years, all the conversations around, you know, CTE mm-hmm. and brain damage mm-hmm. and things like that. And especially too, highlighting that domestic violence arrests that include MMA fighters is more than double that of the average national rate in the U.S. So that's even higher than the rate for NFL players.
Yes.
And so if we're thinking about sports that involve, you know, that are built on violence,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then it's like, this is their profession. This is the way that they think. This is the way that they've been groomed and socialized. A lot of them, like we were talking about with the gymnasts, like, they have been playing this sport a lot of times for their entire lives.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows what types of... Who knows how much damage has been done to their brains?
Yeah.
And the NFL has been really resistant toward taking any type... You know, like, in terms of increasing the padding on helmets and all of these different things that they could do. Like, they've been kind of resistant and really slow-moving. And so, you know, we're asking this question, you know, are these NFL players victims... Or are they perpetrators? And, you know, or can you be both? Do those have to be mutually exclusive categories? Mm-hmm. You know, can they be victims of, you know, like, I don't know, like, brain damage of the NFL's kind of general neglect of their physical health? And, I mean, and mental health, and perpetrators of domestic violence. And, like, how should they be punished differently? Like, how do we even approach talking, like, thinking through this? And I think maybe, I mean, I guess maybe the difficulty in, like, how nuanced this is could also be one of the reasons why the NFL is having a hard time figuring out how to punish them.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, it's like, I don't know. Like, if someone is more prone to violence because they have brain damage, like, do you... put them in jail the same way that you would, like, a regular citizen?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I mean, I agree. And, like, even beyond the fact that multiple concussions have been, like, even, for example, with my brother, like, he had a brain trauma. Mm-hmm. And the neurologist explained to us that where, because he was hit by a car when he was walking. Mm-hmm. And where the location in his brain that got impacted was the part that controls his emotions and his anger. And since then, he only has 0 or 100. Like, mm-hmm. He'll get as angry about something that you should be really angry about, the same level that he'll get angry if someone, like, cut him off, or if he forgot something, or he lost his keys. It's like there's no differentiation of different levels of anger. And so after seeing that, experiencing that with my brother, I was like, I really see, like, they can't control it. And, like, and he gets super angry, scary angry. And even afterwards, I have to explain to him, like, you scare me, and I'm your sister. And I know he would never hurt me because he's my brother. But, like, sometimes when he's that angry, I do get to a point where I'm like, shit, like, I'm a little scared right now. I need to calm down. I need to calm him down. So seeing that with just that one instance of brain trauma, and then thinking about NFL players and MMA fighters who have multiple mm-hmm. instances of trauma, I'm just kind of like, it helps me see it in a perspective of there is a point where they really can't control themselves, and where it really isn't something that they're even aware that is super problematic. Yeah. And then beyond the fact that there's, like, actual brain issues, like, NFL fighters, like, NFL players and MMA fighters, like, their training is to attack and to be very violent. So even, like, in tackling, like, they're told, like, imagine this is someone and, like, hit them as hard as you can. Mm-hmm. And with MMA fighters, they're like, okay, get in the mindset that you're destroying this person. Like, they have to think that way in order to win. And even with athletes, these particular athletes, NFL players and MMA fighters, like, you have to have a certain, like, I'm gonna destroy you mentality in order to be able to be competitive in this sport, and especially, like, certain positions. So yeah, maybe a quarterback doesn't have to worry about hitting another guy the same way that a linebacker does. And so a part of me is like, I think that they are perpetrators, but I also think that they are victims. And I don't think that the NFL or the UFC or Bellator are set up in a way to be able, or maybe they're just unable to or don't want to really address the root cause of this, which would be to make the sport less violent.
And how would you do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how would you maintain, this level of, like, competitiveness or competition or whatever, and make, I mean, what is MMA without violence? It doesn't exist.
No, it wouldn't be a sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it kind of puts these, I don't know. It kind of puts these, like, leagues and stuff like that between a rock and a hard place, because what is the solution?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like there's a solution beyond just ending the sport.
Yeah, I mean, and then we also have to also put the blame on us or fans. I mean, I watch MMA fights. I, watch some boxing, but more MMA, and I used to watch the NFL, but I, like, in an MMA fight, I do watch it, and a part of me, it's hard because I, am with someone who has really kind of explained to me the sport aspect of MMA, which is, like, also, instead of just watching the fights, I'll watch, like, the training up to the fights. And, like, one of my favorite guys is Cormier, who just fought, and he's an Olympic wrestler. And so I see how he trains, and he's, like, very, very dedicated. He's very, very disciplined. There is actually a lot of technique involved. The fact, like, everything in terms of how they pin people, how they put someone in the ground, how they defend someone, the fact that it takes a lot of skill to be able to, like, avoid being hit. But then there are times when I just, like, see someone being knocked out, and I'm like, that is, like, it's terrible to see. I was like, in that moment, like, anytime someone loses consciousness, it is terrible for their brain.
Oh, right? And, like, oh, my God. And so arms breaking.
Yeah, but if you see, like, seeing, like, I go to these, like, Buffalo Wild Wings or whatever, and, like, everyone, like, you just look around, and people are hyped. Yeah. And it's not, and then a lot of times it is very much like, it's not, you know, for me, I like to, I always ask myself, you know, where does race play into this? And like for boxing, for example, like boxing is a very, I mean, a lot, there's a lot of Mexican boxers. Like it's something, and I've talked about this with another colleague of ours who's Puerto Rican, and we bonded over like talking about boxing and fighting and the fact that, like, I mean, even in Mexico, the luchadores, and I know like sometimes that's like staged, and but it's like the violence and the fighting is a part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And so it's a part, it's a way that people bond, and it is a way that, and but you see that, and you see like sold out arenas, and you see people cheering when someone's get knocked out, and you're, whose fault is, if it were not for people demanding this, then these people wouldn't be doing that. And sometimes people love, like, people will say that was such a boring fight if it was no knockouts, if it was just, you know, winning by decision, which means like based on your points and how much technique you did. But and so I think a part of it is these leagues, these the NFL, the UFC do have responsibility. The athletes do have responsibilities themselves for choosing to dedicate their energy to these sports, but also we as fans have to look and think about what part are we playing in being able to just say, fine, Ray Lewis, you're okay, but I really, really like you as a player, and so it's not that bad that you knocked out, you know, your partner, because I like you as a athlete. And so I think that it's just complicated because they're victims as well, and we as fans are, in a way, I think, also part of the perpetrators in this. Like, we are participating in their tearing down of their body, and so I don't know, it's just, it's really complicated. And and then I think with the LeSean McCoy thing, it was, you know, I heard it and I was guilty. Of course he did it. It makes sense. Since it's like, you just don't know. Like, now I'm like, I don't know. Maybe he wasn't, but it would make sense if he was. It's just like, it's just really hard to disentangle what they do as a living, and the fact that they have to be so aggressive and so violent, and separate that from like the fact that these are people who navigate the world with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we think about the fact that, and I guess I'm just kind of really stuck on, like, not, you know, not that I want to take away from the fact that they are, that they've committed these violent acts, which is obviously, very obviously wrong, right? But the types of injuries that they experience are things that, when they occur among regular people, you know, it's like viewed as something that's severe. Yeah. You know, like, you get a concussion, like, you can't go to work, you can't go to sleep.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's something, like, the severity of this is taken much more seriously for the average citizen than it is for athletes. Athletes also often experience concussions and are sent back out on the field.
Yeah.
You know, or we have, or the NFL has its own physicians who are signing off on these players continuing to play, even though they have, you know, sustained, you know, injuries that shouldn't allow them to play. And so I mean, it's at every level. Like, when my brother started playing varsity, like, when he was in, I don't know, 9th or 10th grade, and he was getting concussions. Mm-hmm. And that was just like, you know, I mean, props to him, because he was like, you know what, I think I'm done. Just gonna continue playing baseball. And, you know, because it was like, this is too much. You know, this is too much, especially if you're trying to play, you know, like, I think about the fact that these are people that have been experiencing these types of injuries since they were children.
Yeah.
13,
yeah,
14. That's a lifetime.
Yeah.
Of brain trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I mean, yes, like you're saying, like, I think, like, when we were talking about our episode on, like, violence before we went on break, how we were saying that everybody is implicated in this.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think it's, I mean, I think that it's, that's no less true for these athletes. And I think that, again, like you were saying, this, I guess, I, you know, violence in general is built into our culture, yeah. on and off the field.
Yeah.
You know, and so if even if we look at the way that fans of the NFL respond to protests by NFL players about violence being committed against their against people in their community, it's like, no, we don't, that that's not, you know, that's not a part of, that's not a part of the NFL. Keep that out of sport. You know, as if there is this super bold line differentiating violence on and off the field, and it's like, no.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, and the fact that we, like, don't see these with all athletes. Like, yeah. do you see, I mean, I don't know. I just, I'm trying
swimmers.
To think. Yeah, I'm just trying to think what other sports, okay, baseball, mm-hmm. Basketball, soccer. And I'm thinking, like, yeah, there are, you do tend to see more of, okay, maybe among basketball players, you see more stories of, like, infidelity or of, like, drunk driving or of all these things. But in terms of, like, domestic violence, I just, it's just, the more violent the sport, it seems like the more correlation there is yeah. with violent crimes. And I mean, the Aaron Hernandez case, where mm-hmm. he was a player for the New England Patriots and he murdered someone, and you find out after his autopsy that he had, they said he had the worst case of CTE that they've ever seen.
Ever seen.
And that his brain was like that of an old person with dementia, and he was young. And so, yeah. and then the I think the, what adds to it is, like, you can't really know until people die if they have CTE. It's just kind of like Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
It can't be, you can't know what the, with the brain, you can't know brain damage until you see it enacted. And, like, even with my brother, it took us a while to figure out, like, oh, this is due to the fact that he had a brain trauma. And even though you don't, and it's harder because you don't, it's not something you can see. If we could see these players physically on their body, like, just all cut up and all this all the time, that would help us understand. But you don't see them. Even with MMA fighters, they don't really show you the fallout after a fight. You might see a clean picture, but you don't see the fact, you don't see the hospital bills, you don't see the fact that they, you know, didn't, they have memory loss, you don't see the fact that they don't know what the year is. It's like, we don't see so much of it that I think allows us to kind of desensitize to what's happening. And I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking how we're supposed to respond. And I, you know, before we started recording, I was telling you about how recently the NFL Players Association Commission on Violence Prevention experts resigned. And so there was two women, Epstein and Goodman, and one was like the director of domestic violence in, she's the director of the Georgetown University Law Center's Domestic Violence Clinic. And then another one is a research psychologist who was authorized to conduct a national study of players' wives, collecting the suggestions for how to handle domestic violence. And so when I read that, I was like, that is exactly what we should do. Use research, you know, these are women, like they totally, the NFL was really smart in choosing women, choosing people with PhDs, choosing researchers. But what was really sad is that in explaining why they resigned, one of them says, I brought a number of ideas to the commission about the ways in which they could deal with the domestic violence problem in the NFL. She said that the report compiled short-term and long-term recommendations. She said that the commission heard her out, but since she filed the report in June of 2016, so that's 2 years ago, it has sat on the shelf. The Players Association contacts that I have would welcome those ideas, tell me they were very doable, but that they had to get kicked down the road because it was the Super Bowl, it was the draft, it was the season. And I would come back to reiterate my suggestions, and eventually I found out that communication would just die on the vine. I realized that very little, if anything, was going to happen. And so as a result, they resigned. And so it's just kind of like feeling that it's just for show. Like, maybe they don't want answers. Maybe they do know.
Yeah, they like definitely know.
Just like with CTE, there's evidence that the NFL already knows that it's really bad. I mean, the same thing happened with cigarettes. Like, Johnson & Johnson knew cigarettes killed people, but they were trying to, like, discredit the scientists or discredit the research or just prolong and postpone all this. And then, you know, it's just like I always say, I was bringing back to race. Like, what does this mean about these athletes? Like, a lot of athletes of color find this is like their way out. A lot of times it's like, you know, you either get an academic scholarship or you get an athletic scholarship. And like making it to the NFL, making it to MMA, being a star, like you get money. Like, a lot of times I just hear people saying, like, I wanted to get money to help my family. I wanted to get money to support. I wanted to get money to buy my mom a house. I wanted to get money to be okay. And I think just along the way, there's no, I just don't think people really care about them. I feel like they use their bodies. I mean, how long can someone really play for the NFL? How long can someone really be an MMA fighter? So we use them up, we exploit them. Sure, they make a ton of money while they're doing it, but then what? They're like 40, they have the body probably of a 60 or 80 year old, and they have no other ways to make money, and they have this brain damage plus a criminal record. So it's,
and that's if they stay playing that long.
That's
like
true.
If you know, if you play less than 4 years, then what?
Yeah.
Then what? You have no pension.
Yeah.
You know, when you have no like skills, no usable skills.
Yeah.
Like, this is, I mean, the NFL has so many issues, and not just the NFL. I mean, even like the NCAA, like there's so many, and it just goes down all the way down to Pop Warner, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's exploitation at its finest, you know. And I think that the fact that, like you're saying, there are so many people that are using this as a means of getting out of the hood, that there is, regardless of how much we complain, regardless of how many people shed light on these issues, they aren't going to do anything because they don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't enough people willing to protest, willing to stop watching. There aren't enough people willing to boycott. There are people that are upset that there are boycotts happening right now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, so, and I mean, when you have major companies and corporations, companies like Papa John's, you know, they are alleging complaints against the NFL for boycotts, for not doing enough to stop them. You know, and so the NFL is so powerful. Like, it's such a shame. And these people's lives are just caught in the balance, and they don't care. Because it's like, you know, once we're done using your body, there are plenty more like you, plenty more waiting to take your place.
Yeah, yeah.
That know that all of these things, that know about CTE, that know about the potential for brain trauma, and are willing to go through it to support their families.
Yeah, and that's what makes it dangerous, that there's, you know, it's just, yeah. And so this conversation is just very complicated. And so that's why we kind of pose the question as perpetrator, are they perpetrators and victims? Because I think to just label them as one or the other is not really looking at the complete picture and not really being fair. And I know, like, some people might be like, how am I supposed to feel sorry for LaShawn McCoy, who's like a millionaire and has a mansion? And it's like, yeah, but, you know,
that's capitalism speaking for us.
Yeah.
Like, that's capitalism that's blinding us to what real abuse and suffering is. The idea that, oh, because this person has all this money, they should have no complaints.
Yeah.
You know, their life is perfect. And it's like, no, we're being disillusioned by capitalism, by thinking that money is the solution to all things. If you have all the money in the world, but your quality of life is shit, like, what is that? What can money buy you?
Yeah.
Money can't buy them more life.
Yeah, yeah.
Money can't buy them, you know, a decent quality of life if they had brain trauma and they lose their families. Like, you know, in that movie, whatever that movie was that Will Smith was in, like,
Concussion.
I mean, yeah, Concussion. Like, people are, like, their families are being, forcibly, you know, it's like, I can't stay around you if you're beating on me.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, they lose everything. They lose everything because of this. And they're putting, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, we talk in sociology, we talk a lot about what choice is. You know, and so, yes, they're kind of opting into this, but at the same time, what choice do they have? What alternative do they have? You know, I mean, yeah, and like Zelma's saying, like, it's so complex. Like, it's so complicated. You can't, it's not black or white. You can't boil it down to, you can't boil it down to, like, you know, perpetrator or victim. Like, it's both mm-hmm. at the same time. Mm-hmm. At the same time. And so it's like, should we, if we scale it back, you know, and we look at the bigger picture, like, the, I feel like the real corporate, the real culprit is the NFL.
Yeah, or, like, you know? These, I mean, even with the sexual abuse case that we were talking about in our In the Know segment, like, these are Olympic medalists that are famous, that are well-known, that are loved by, you know, us, and they felt so vulnerable and so unable to feel protected by the USA Olympic Committee that, and they even went to them and were like, hey, this issue is happening, I am being abused, and they didn't do anything about it for a very, very, very long time.
Decades. Like,
yeah, what? So it's just kind of like, you know, athletes, I think, sometimes are given, people just aren't very nice or empathetic about the fact that just because in some ways they do have a lot of power, in some ways they do make a lot of money, in some ways they do have a lot of fame, you see them on TV, they have books, they have all these things, they have commercials, but we also have, like, they are also just pawns in a larger system, mm-hmm. and if they, as much money as they are making, there are men sitting in really nice offices making a lot more money, and those are the people that really need to be held more accountable. And just to get mad at the athletes and to say the problem is with the athletes is to overlook the fact that they are just embedded in a system and in institutions that are allowing this to happen and
built on built on exploitation.
Yeah.
And we, I mean, it's hard because we were kind of born into this too. Like, the, you know, the NFL predates us and all these committees and commissions predate us, but the fact that our society allowed for these entities to grow so powerful that we cannot hold the individuals within them accountable is such a shame.
Yeah.
Because it's like, now, I mean, what can we do at this point? Like, they're so big.
Yeah.
Like, these commissions are bigger than politicians. Politicians can't do shit.
No. I mean, yeah. Money really talks. And these things, the NFL makes a lot of money. And they have a lot to lose if anything changes.
And so
it's just really hard. And then just, you know, what we talked about with the two women resigning, they have all the money in the world, all the resources, all the you know, they can be as educated as they want, but it really comes down to they don't want to change, and why would they? Because it would impact the bottom dollar, the bottom line. And so it's just a very complicated thing. And so we just wanted just to kind of present, you know, both sides of the coin of this discussion in terms of athletes and abuse, and just kind of, like, for me, just checking myself with the LaShawn McCoy thing and just being like, okay, like, it's not always just plain, like, oh, he's violent, that makes sense because he's an athlete or an NFL player. It's like looking deeper and looking further and looking beyond just the story and examining all the different players and the institutions and the owners and the commissions and everyone involved and the, you know, the coaches and the physicians, and just kind of remembering that it's a huge system. It's a structure that's at play, and these players are just one part of it.
Okay, well, I think wrap up there. Thanks so much for listening.
Yes, if you have any comments, feedback, or questions, if you have any ideas about topics or want to extend the conversation or anything that we talked about, if you're an athlete yourself or if you know someone and you'd like to share, please just email us at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at wokeishpodcast. You can send us a DM. or you can like our videos, comment on our videos. We usually provide a clip from some of our segments during the week of the episode. So feel free to just give us any feedback. Also,
like it, share it, retweet.
And also follow us on Twitter
at WokeishPod.
At WokeishPod. So we thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.